Om Gyanatimadandasya Gyananjana Sakya Chakshundaritamye Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Dhanananda Shri Adwaita Shri Vasudeva
Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare.
This evening we'll be discussing Vedic selfhood. You may be surprised to know that understanding the self is the greatest vacuum in Western knowledge. Maybe you wouldn't be. Maybe you wouldn't be surprised to know that, judging the situation by the effects, all the social horrors that we described this morning are a result of not having any knowledge of the true self, and all the stability, integrity, and responsibility that the Indian culture is famous for, that actually comes from a clear understanding of what the self is. We need to pin ourselves down. Am I matter? Am I spirit? Am I both? How do these two energies relate? Krishna explains this in Bhagavad Gita, that you are the spirit soul within a material body. In the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Asmin Dehe, within the body there's the spirit soul. And that spirit soul has no birth or death, beginning or end. Why should we think that Bhagavad Gita is mythological when from the very beginning you're presented with a clear analysis of who you are? Now, do you get such a clear analysis from material science? Let us begin our meditation on this quote by a Nobel laureate, the Frenchman, Monnet. How do you feel about that? The ancient covenant is in pieces. That means all kinds of ancient knowledge, all kinds of ancient culture, forget it. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he has emerged only by chance. Neither his destiny nor his duty has been written down. How do you feel about that? Who here likes that? Don't be afraid to. Anyone here? Yes, yes. No one. How many of you reject that completely? Raise your hand. And how many are not sure? Raise your hand. Okay, one of us. So, this brilliant statement, still revered today, is what so much of the Western materialistic science is based on. What does materialism mean? As scientists themselves describe, materialism means that everything in the universe, animate or inanimate, can be described according to the laws of physics. Everything can be described in terms of the movements of material entities. Anyone here accept that? In other words, to be a materialist doesn't simply mean that you're greedy or you have too much money. Having too much money means having someone has more money than you. That's too much. Each one thinks, I have the right amount of money, or I have less than I need. But the other person, he's the materialist, he has more money. Too much. Right? Actually, materialist means that you think everything in existence can be described in terms of matter, in terms of laws of physics. Now, you have to think about that. Whether you think that is an adequate description of all reality. Is it so that your destiny and your duty has never been written down? Many will agree. Yes, that's why we are liberated from all scriptures, all shastras, all traditions. We're just alone in the vastness of the universe. And we have emerged into this universe just out of chance. But so many of you won't accept that. And many of you are in between. But you have to confront this head on. This is being clear-headed in your thinking. Are you matter, or are you something else than matter? Now, we'll be surprised to find out that when it comes to consciousness, Western knowledge is far behind. Maybe some of you are thinking that how can it be that we are approaching the ancient Vedic texts like Bhagavad Gita for knowledge of consciousness? How can it be that these ancient texts are speaking about consciousness? These antiquated folklore texts. But what you should be wondering is the opposite. How is it that the wonderful, great, extraordinary current science knows practically very little about consciousness? In other words, if you want to have doubt, you have to have the doubt in the right direction. Why is it that science as it is today knows so little about consciousness? Did you know, I was explaining this point at IIT in Mumbai, there's not one scientific instrument in the world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. Not one. As supposedly great as science is now, all you can do is infer that you have consciousness, someone has consciousness. Based on the fact that you have it, you assume everyone has it. That's all. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to discuss this consciousness. We're going to discuss the unknown knower in your body. And we'll discuss various extraordinary true facts that let you know there has to be something more to consciousness than just the brain. The hope amongst materialists today is that consciousness is something that emanates from the brain. They have no proof of this, but they have to hope in that way. But we're going to give you some surprising information that will show you it's impossible to think that. Why is knowledge of the self important? Well, if you don't know who you are, how can you act properly? In other words, if you think that you're just the body, then you'll devote your whole life to bodily pursuits, trying to satisfy yourself in that way. But if you understand that you have a spiritual, non-material identity, then you will dedicate your life to spiritual activities as the main thing, while taking care of the body as a subordinate thing. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that the body is like a garment. You put it on and you take it off. The soul wears the garments. The soul wears these clothes of the body. But you're not the clothes, similarly you're not the body. You must know what you are so that you can decide what your mission in life is. Life in this world is a combination of the spirit soul and the material body. Of the two, the spirit soul is most important because that has no beginning or end. You have to take care of your temporary body, but it is not so important. Just like the clothes you're wearing. You have to take care of the clothes you're wearing, but you never confuse your clothes to be yourself. No one here makes that mistake. But, so then why do we want to dedicate so much of our energies just for the body? This we have to think of. Now, the famous psychoanalyst Jung, he had an understanding that all of the psychologically disturbed patients that he studied were lacking a proper spiritual understanding of the self. That was his observation. He wrote this. Among all my patients in the second half of life, meaning adults, every one of them fell ill because he had lost what the living religions of every age have given their followers. And none of them has really been healed who did not regain his religious outlook. So then he was questioned, what do you mean by religious outlook? And he replied, when you study the mental history of the world, you see that people, since time immemorial, had a general teaching or doctrine about the wholeness of the world. This has been the case in primitive tribes, as well as in highly differentiated civilizations. In our civilization, this spiritual background has gone astray. Our Christian doctrine has lost its grip to an appalling extent, chiefly because people don't understand it anymore. As these views deal with the world as a whole, they create also a wholeness of the individual. People are no longer rooted in their world and lose their orientation. They just drift. The problem cannot be settled by a few slogans. Now, we were speaking a little bit about other religions this morning, comparing them to an abridged dictionary, pocket dictionary. When you look at Judaism, Christianity, Islam, as ordinarily known, and these religious traditions do have their mystical branches, but most people don't know about that. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, as ordinarily known, they very diligently drill us in moral values, basic morals, but give very little analytical knowledge of the self. Now, the Vedic tradition gives volumes of information about your spiritual identity, but even people who claim to follow Vedic knowledge, they don't know this information, and therefore they just follow the religious rituals and formulas without taking advantage of the extraordinary comprehensive knowledge of the self that the Vedic texts give. In other religious traditions of the world, that knowledge is not there. It's very little. But in the Vedic knowledge, so much information is there about consciousness and the self. But most practitioners, most people who follow the Vedic texts, like Bhagavad Gita, they have no idea of the extraordinary wealth of knowledge in their own tradition. They just follow some rituals, do some puja, as we were talking this morning. Do puja for someone, something, anything. Just do puja. They don't know that they have access to such extraordinary amounts of knowledge. In fact, I realize that they assume, because Western science has very little knowledge about the self, therefore, how can the Vedic texts have any knowledge of the self? It all makes sense. See? It all adds up. You get it? If the greatest scientists of the world have no knowledge of the self, then surely we shouldn't think that the the Vedic texts, had knowledge of the self. So I realized these people don't even think to look at the Vedic texts because it just must be that everyone's in ignorance of the self because we didn't learn about it in school because we were not taught about the conscious self at the university. Therefore, no one must know about it. And so just live your life without knowledge of the self. That's the normal thing. When you fall into this trap, then you have effectively wasted your human form of life. Now, when we turn to the Vedic perspective, we find that the Vedic texts thrive on the challenge of understanding the conscious self. What Western knowledge shies away from, the Vedic texts take head on. Therefore, in just chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna starts talking about your true identity. And Bhagavad Gita explains that you acquire material bodies according to your state of mind at the time of death. And you, the spirit soul, go from one body to another. So, anyone who is serious about truly living a life in reality, they must access this extraordinary knowledge of the self. But you'd be surprised. So many people, even from India, never think to do that. In other words, they go on in the bodily concept of life while doing a bit of puja. This is what you see at so many so-called Hindu temples. No knowledge. Little puja here, little puja there, and then social life. Because they are ignoring the vast storehouse of knowledge about the self and its situation in this world. And they're just focusing on empty rituals, habitual, traditional activities. But the knowledge is not there. Therefore, so many of you don't take it seriously. You go for these rituals because your parents did it. You go for social life at so many of these Hindu temples. We have a few in Melbourne also. You can go there and you can meet people, talk about immigration, talk about job opportunities. After a little bit of puja to whoever, Shiva, Durga, Vishnu, whoever, whatever. But real spiritual knowledge is something else. And that's what we are presenting in Krishna consciousness, Sanatana Dharma, the spiritual wealth of the Vedic texts. Now, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. Where are you going to find consciousness from the material point of view? You all know you have consciousness. And it is a fact that only because you have consciousness are you aware of yourself and what's around you. You can't jump outside of your consciousness. Try to do it now. Try to jump outside of your conscious awareness and become aware of your conscious awareness. Can't do it. What is it that's aware of the various things in your consciousness? Now, where do you find that conscious aware entity? Where do you find it in terms of biochemistry? You cannot. Now, it is a fact that you can influence the contents of your consciousness by changing the chemicals in the brain. But that doesn't mean you have shown that consciousness is a biochemical affair. You may be influenced by something, but that doesn't mean you are that thing. There's a big difference between having the states of consciousness influenced by chemical changes and saying that consciousness is chemicals. Big difference. We have to keep that in mind. You cannot jump outside of your consciousness. Because of your consciousness, you are aware of everything. Now, what is the composition of that consciousness? As analytical persons, so many of you are technically minded, scientifically minded, then what is the nature of this consciousness? Current scientific knowledge can't give a clear answer. You have some scientists who are convinced consciousness is matter. They have no proof, but they're convinced, dogmatically. You have other scientists who are quite sure you cannot explain consciousness materially. And then you have a vast group in between who just don't know. That's the state of scientific research into consciousness today. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes the situation very clear. Just like the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so the living entity, the spirit soul within the body, illuminates the entire body by consciousness. Now, the fact that you cannot understand consciousness materially lets you know that there is something inconceivable about your identity. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that the consciousness is the symptom of the soul's existence. You cannot explain consciousness materially because consciousness is showing you the existence of the soul, and the soul cannot be understood materially. So you can immediately cut through so much social conditioning and educational brainwashing just by grasping this consciousness puzzle. Consciousness cannot be explained materially. There's no scientific proof whatsoever that consciousness is something material that emanates from the brain. That's just a religious belief held by stubborn scientists who refuse to admit that there can be something non-material about reality. So these things you have to decide yourself. You have to think about these things yourself. But these subjects are dealt with directly in Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. So, where's the mythology then, I ask you? You want to talk about mythology and legend, then you have to talk about the Western scientific approach to the self. It's simply mythology and legend. Now, what happens when you dream at night? When you dream at night, you see things, you feel things, you taste things. And then when you wake up, that dream world disappears. But what about the world while you're awake? When you go to sleep, that world disappears. And when you die, both the night world and the day world disappear. Nevertheless, the consciousness exists. It is your consciousness that witnesses the daydream and the night dream. It is your consciousness that survives death, because consciousness is indicating the presence of the soul. Consciousness is the energy of the soul. So your world is always changing, your body is always changing, your mind is always changing, but your consciousness that remains through all the challenges. You don't lose your consciousness. How many of you, when you go to sleep at night, think you've lost consciousness? None of you think like that. It's just the objects of your consciousness change. The day world goes out of your consciousness, and what enters is the night world. Now, why is it that you say the day world is more substantial than the night world? It's because day after day, what you wake up to is still there. Whereas when you go to sleep at night, the night world comes and then it disappears and you you never get the same dream. But the day world, when you wake up, Monday is there, Tuesday is there, Wednesday is there. Night world, you could dream one thing Monday night, another thing Tuesday night. But at the time of death, everything goes, the day world and the night world, and you change to a new body. We should try to understand this conscious entity that does not change, although the body and mind are changing. That is the real necessity in our life. Because as long as you think that you're the body, as long as you think you're the mind, then you'll try to satisfy your body and mind. And that's not possible. You will not be satisfied in that way. It is up to us to understand our spiritual identity and try to satisfy ourselves spiritually. So this is the number one reason why Sanatana Dharma, Krishna consciousness, Bhakti Yoga, is essential. If you want to satisfy yourself, you must know what the self is. And Western knowledge gives no definitive understanding of the self. In Western knowledge, the self is a myth. It's a legend. That's it. Who would ever dream that the greatest answers to the riddles of consciousness and the self are found in the ancient Vedic texts? But it's there, so clearly. Now, maybe some of you have heard of the expression, the ghost in the machine. Any of you heard that before? This is a modern scientific put-down of anyone who believes in the soul. They say, oh, you're chasing that ghost in the machine, huh? Actually, no. Their very words can be turned upon them. Basically, they're saying, you're chasing an unknown entity called the soul that you say inhabits the machine of the body. So then they speak in that derogatory, or that demeaning way, condescending way. Ah, you believe in the ghost in the machine. You believe that in the human body there's some kind of unknown entity. Now, you can present the reverse. You can tell them, you are holding to the machine that's in the ghost. You say we are chasing the ghost in the machine, but we look at it the other way. You are focusing on the machine and the ghost in that you don't know what the self is. You don't know what the body, what allows your body to be perceived. Only because of consciousness can you be aware of the body, the machine, but you don't know what consciousness is. So therefore, how can you understand your body? In other words, the self is unknown to you. So how then can you really say you understand what the self perceives? You see? Everything you perceive comes to you through your consciousness. Whether it's IT or your family, your society, it all comes to you through your conscious awareness. So if you don't know what consciousness is, it means you don't understand the things that come to you through your consciousness. In other words, by the means of an unknown, you think you're knowing things. How is that possible? How can you know something through the means of an unknown? Well, this is the corner that Western knowledge is backed into. And this is why there's such havoc in the world now. Everyone thinks they know so much, but all their knowledge and awareness and perception comes to them through something that is unknown, consciousness. Vedic knowledge begins with consciousness. First understand consciousness, then you can say you know all the things that your consciousness is aware of. So now I hope you're starting to understand why you'll just go crazy according to the materialistic conception of life. Ultimately, it will drive you nuts because there's no foundation. If you don't understand consciousness, how can you say you understand the awareness of things that come to you through your consciousness? How can you have the known based on the unknown? Impossible. That's what's going on these days. Whereas Krishna conscious knowledge begins with first understand consciousness and then talk about what you know and what you're aware of. That's much more intelligent. Now, sometimes persons who are a little bit spiritually interested become attracted to impersonalism. This is the other problem in India's spiritual culture. The first problem is the caste system, which has nothing to do with Vedic knowledge. And the second problem is impersonalism. So many spiritual teachers in India today advocate that there's no supreme entity, that we all are spiritual and we all are the ultimate spiritual reality. One famous teacher of this belief will just tell you, I am God, you are God. The only difference between me and you is that I can remember I'm God and you have forgotten you're God. Yes, this is, and people like to hear this. We all are Brahman, we all are the all-pervading. It is us and we are it. Now it's true that there are statements in the Upanishads which, if wrongly understood, could cause you to think that way. In the Upanishads, well, let's put it this way. The Upanishads are texts meant to introduce you to the spiritual reality. So in order to properly introduce you to the spiritual reality, the Upanishads give you negative statements to clear out your preconceptions. The spirit soul is not this, it's not that. Krishna also does it in Bhagavad Gita. It can't be cut, it can't be dried, it can't be burned. When you're talking about something inconceivable, it's often easier to start by describing what it isn't. And then in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives you a hint of what it is. Eternal, primeval. So the Upanishads, they do like that. So much negative description. Just so that you'll clear out your preconceptions. Now, some people can't see beyond that, though. They don't understand that when the Upanishads say, it is not this, it is not that. This is just introductory knowledge. What are you, though? Okay, first understand what you're not, then understand what you are. Those who misunderstand think that when the Upanishads describe the self as Brahman, the all-pervading spiritual reality, that's just an introduction. Just like you're introducing the sun to someone, and you say, look at the all-pervading sunlight. And the person says, oh, sunlight all around. But you know the sunlight is coming from the sun. Similarly, those who actually understand Vedic knowledge know that all these spiritual energies coming from the Supreme Soul. The Supreme Soul, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, emanates the individual spirit souls as well as the material energy of matter. So you have to know where to trace the energy back to. But there's so many spiritual misunderstandings now that there's just the all-pervading energy. That's like saying, there's just the sunlight, there's no sun. And we are that all-pervading energy. I am it. It is me. You are me. I am you. That's it. And often in these spiritual misunderstandings, you'll notice that the followers just say, just everything is the same. Just be and do and offer the results to. And sometimes they gesture. It is all up to.
Yeah.
It is the. They point to the sky or something. It's just. And you're supposed to, oh, yes, yes, I understand. We offer our pranams to the. And then you're supposed to also, oh, I understand. And then this goes further. It'll be said that worship any deity you like, Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, Durga, it doesn't matter, because behind all these deities is the same all-pervading reality. So it doesn't matter. Just do puja for something. Because they're all just faces for the impersonal energy. And worship wherever you like. Durga, Shiva, Vishnu, Sachin, is he still a star in cricket? Do we worship him? It's all just faces on the impersonal Brahman. This is not what the Shastra teaches. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says quite clearly, Brahmana hipatishtam, I am the basis of this spreading of impersonal energy everywhere. In other words, Krishna is saying, the impersonal is based on me, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, the person. Just like you're a person, you know how to act impersonally. Similarly, Krishna has his impersonal presence as the all-pervading, his all-pervading energy that spreads everywhere. So let us not confuse the individual soul with the supreme soul. The individual minute consciousness with the supreme consciousness, Bhagavan Krishna. There's a big difference. As you read Prabhupada's books more and more, you'll understand this personalism and impersonalism. It's very important. Because this is one of the two things that has ruined India's spiritual contribution to the world. Number one, as I said, is the caste system, which is a perverted idea. Number two is this impersonalism as the ultimate reality. And therefore people don't mind, don't care who they're doing puja to. Because ultimately it's all the same. The personalities are superficial. Behind the personalities is an all-pervading oneness, Brahman, the energy. That is the assumption all this vagueness is based on. But that is not what Krishna talks about in Bhagavad Gita. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna clearly asserts himself as the source of everything. Now, you've heard so many promises from Western science that the self is simply chemicals. I'll read you some of them. Here is a cell biologist, a famous cell biologist from Duke University, Harold Erickson. The secret of life is not a secret anymore. We've known for 20 or 30 years now that life is not more mysterious than the chemical reactions on which it is based. There's an incredibly complex set of chemical reactions, but they're all logical and understandable. We don't yet understand them all. But we do understand a lot of them, and it's not hard to see that eventually we should know them all. But it can get much worse than that. Here's Tom Pollard. He's a cell biologist who heads the world-famous Salk Institute in California. And he's a former president of the American Society for Cell Biology. He says, "What molecular biologists have believed for two generations is now generally regarded as proved beyond any doubt. Life is entirely the result of physics and chemistry inside cells and among cells. I wonder whether the general public is prepared to sign on." So, what do you think? Sounds good, huh? Unless you are knowledgeable in the proper way, you'll be fooled by all this. And actually, there's so many Nobel laureate scientists who say the opposite, but you don't hear about them. For example, one Nobel laureate, Eugene Wigner, says that the possibility of a self-duplicating unit emerging on its own is zero. He concludes that our present understanding of physics and chemistry does not enable us to explain the phenomenon of life. Then we can turn to the chairman of the Origin of Life Research for America's National Academy of Sciences. You see, the American biologists became so bewildered trying to prove their assertion that life comes from chemicals that they set up a special committee to analyze the situation. And this is what the chairman of that committee, Harold P. Klein, concluded. He said, "The simplest bacterium is so damn complicated from the point of view of a chemist that it's almost impossible to imagine how it happened." So this committee, established by the National Academy of Sciences in the USA, reviewed all the theories for how life comes from chemicals, hoping to find a winner. And their conclusion was, "We are unable to endorse any of the competitors." "We are unable to endorse any of the candidates. No theories." So they said, "We just hope in the future more research will solve the problem." I remember when I was going to grade school in the 50s, we were all taught about Stanley Miller. Anyone here ever heard of Stanley Miller? Yes. He was a great god of chemical research. So, supposedly, in 1953, he demonstrated in his laboratory how the first chemicals of life arose on their own. You're still being taught this?
I already learned that.
Yes. But when did you learn it?
It was a long time ago.
Yes. How many years back?
About 3 or 4 years.
That's not a long time.
I forgot the whole experiment that he set up.
Yes, but still it was taught to you.
Yeah.
So for so long, even now still, it's presented as showing that from a mixture, a frog, a brew of basic chemicals that were probably present on primitive Earth, self-replicating molecules emerge spontaneously. Okay? In other words, life emerged spontaneously from this brew of primitive chemicals on the primitive Earth. And so, ever since 1953, Stanley Miller has been revered. Is he still getting puja? What happened?
Nothing. Like, you could prove it, and there was no further conclusion, evidence yet.
Right.
That it can happen.
Right, but for so many decades he was revered. And then gradually he's, you know, taken off the altar. And someone else is put on the altar. What happened was that in his old age, a few years ago, he admitted himself, "My famous experiment has gone nowhere." He himself said that. But I remember in grade school, high school, university, it wasn't told to us like that. "Oh, Stanley Miller's brilliant experiment shows that it is highly possible. Given a significant amount of time, and take into account the forces of random chance that basic primitive chemicals will spontaneously give rise to a living entity. And now, in his old age, Stanley Miller himself says, this experiment goes nowhere. But 40 years has passed in which so many students in school are taught that this shows you life can come from matter. The fact that he himself now says his experiment goes nowhere, that's not publicized. You have to dig to find that information. Well, this is the conditioning that's going on. What we're trying to do in our Krishna conscious efforts to educate people is to gather the statements by so many leading scientists who will tell the truth. Here's another Nobel Prize winner, Albert Szent-Györgyi. He tried to understand the mystery of life by studying the environment, then he switched to cells, then he switched to the chemistry of proteins. Finally, he settled upon electrons, thinking they'll be the clues to life. But as he got near the end of his life, he confessed, "In my search for the secret of life, I ended up with atoms and electrons which have no life at all. Somewhere along the line, life ran out through my fingers." So now, in my old age, I am retracing my steps. So is this what you want to happen to you? Why not understand what Krishna presents in Bhagavad Gita? That life comes from life. That's actually what Krishna is saying. From the supreme life, the other life comes. Krishna presents himself in Bhagavad Gita as the supreme life. From that supreme life comes matter and other life forms. Why is that so hard to understand? Why do we find it easier to understand that life comes from matter? We've never seen that. There's no scientific proof for it. But in order to avoid Krishna, you'll go for that mythology. Yes, life comes from matter. It's a legend, but you'll accept it. Just give a certain amount of time, and by chance, it'll all happen. This is legend. This is myth. Now, what about the difference between a living body and a dead body? Who knows the difference? We don't have any medical students here, do we? All IT here? Still in the IT world. Huh? How many of your IT students? Raise your hand. Oh, it's reducing a bit. And then the rest are engineers of other electrical, mechanical, chemical. What else do we have besides IT? What kind of?
Huh?
How many are business management? Business management, what does that mean? Never mind what life is, just make money, right? Whatever you think life is, don't, it doesn't matter, we'll sell it. So, we don't have any medical students here. No, not one. Okay.
I can tell you some difference. I mean, physical difference, like a living and dead body.
Yes.
A fast stops.
What is your field?
No, I'm basically from a life sciences background.
Uh-huh.
Done bachelor's in science.
Uh-huh.
But I came here and shifted to IT.
Why?
No, I was just.
Why did you shift?
No, actually, I wanted to combine life sciences with IT and something with industry.
What happened?
I'm still in the process. There it goes.
So, what's the difference between?
Yeah, I mean, physical terms, what you can say is a dead body.
Scientific terms.
Yeah, scientific terms. Yeah.
Physical terms, scientific terms, because all science can tell you about is the physical. You're trapped already, you see. you are a genuine scientist, according to the narrow conception of today, all you can talk about is the physical. You're trapped. You can't go out of that. So, what you explain to me, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body?
Dead body, the heart, brain doesn't function, and there's no circulation of blood, and the body starts getting decayed.
Yes.
And the cells, they are like my heart, but they are bacteria, and the whole body slowly disintegrates.
But at the time of death, before the deterioration noticeably starts, because even while you're living, you could say the body's deteriorating, the skin is, flaking, organs are breaking down, but there's some regeneration. But at the time of death, what is the difference between living body and dead bodies? Is there a difference in weight?
The body loses energy.
Loses the energy. What field are you in? But you can say that the part of the program became corrupted, huh? You have to reinstall the software.
I'm a business management guy, but I just try to attempt. new cells won't get formed.
I want to know, right at the time of death, what is the difference between a living body and a dead body? Yes.
Consciousness.
I think conscious.
We hear that everybody has a premonition that the soul is leaving the body. They have a premonition. They do know that, yes, the soul is leaving the body and is going to die.
Who knows?
The person who is going to die, who's leaving the body, the soul is leaving the body. And they do give the symptoms saying that, yes, the last moments.
I want to know from the physical point of view.
Activity is lost.
Activity is lost. What kind of activity?
The symptoms of life.
No. What are the symptoms of life?
Feeling, breathing, and desiring.
What about someone in a coma?
There's not much difference.
More conscious.
No.
See, near-death experience, that's the one, because there has been experiments conducted, and they came back to the normal state, and they saw the soul has came out.
Start losing senses?
Yeah. Basically, it's loss of consciousness. That's the
How do you detect that, scientifically, that there's a loss of consciousness?
The heart is the first place to detect. It stops functioning.
When the heart stops, that means the consciousness is lost, you're sure?
Yeah.
You brought up near-death experiences. In near-death experiences, persons have been clinically pronounced dead and then later are revived, and they can tell you exactly what was going on in the operating room. Flat EKG readings, no brain waves, all life symptoms gone, and then they're pronounced dead, and then they are revived. And they can tell you all the medical procedures that were being performed on them, even though they're not trained at all in medical science. These things are documented. How could the person describe what's happening unless the person, other than the person having seen what's going on, because the person has no medical knowledge. And yet, and the person's pronounced as medically dead, clinically dead, yet they come back and they say, you did this, you did that, this is what you were doing, I could see it all from a vantage point above the operating table. What do you say about that? If you want to understand the difference between a living body and a dead body, yes, you have to understand the presence or absence of consciousness. What is it about a person that makes you attracted to that person while the person's alive? When someone dies that you like very much, family member, mother, father, you're crying, he's gone, she's gone, But what is gone? The body is right there. Why you're not attracted? The body is right there. And you're crying, he's gone, she's gone, never again, never again.
Life
is gone. Huh? What is that?
The life of the person.
What is that?
The soul.
Giving me these Hindu legends now. So you see, I'm pushing you right up against the wall so you understand what you're dealing with. You have to think about these things. You have to understand what is the self. Otherwise, how can you live your life properly? You need precise knowledge. Just like in your various respective fields, business management, engineering, IT, you can't be fuzzy and vague. You have to be precise. Why is it that when it comes to your own life, it's all right for everything to be fuzzy and vague? Why is that? How can you be satisfied with that? How can you tolerate that? Everything about your occupation has to do with precision. When it comes to your own life, all that can be so vague and fuzzy and I don't know and whatever. And no intelligent person can live like that. All right. The great brain hope. That is the current thing today. That everything can be explained in terms of electrochemical reactions in the brain. The hope is that by understanding the brain, you'll see that consciousness emanates from the brain. One scientist from Princeton University who is adamantly opposed to this materialistic conception, he said, trying to show that consciousness emerges from the brain is the same as trying to show that time emerges from a clock. Have any of you ever seen time emerge from a clock? No. Similarly, you've never seen consciousness emerge from a brain. Now, time is associated with the clock, and consciousness is associated with the brain. But to say that consciousness emerges out of the brain is as ridiculous as saying time emerges out of a clock. Let's look at some brain research. Very interesting. By the way, I mentioned in my book that many of you know that the Russian communists, they preserved the body of Lenin in Lenin's tomb in Moscow. Any of you visited Lenin's tomb in Moscow? No? And also the Chinese government has preserved the body of Mao Zedong. Yes, any of you visited that? But Western scientists have preserved Einstein's brain. Their hope is that by preserving his brain, one day we'll understand the secrets of his intelligence. Now, a Nobel laureate named Wilder Penfield, he's a Canadian, late Canadian physiologist. He was actually searching for the soul by experimenting on people's brains. So what he would do is that he would take an electric probe and he would stimulate various areas of their motor cortex, part of their brain, to see which part of the brain controls which part of the body. So he would stimulate a certain place in the motor cortex, and the person's arm would automatically start lifting. And so Penfield would ask the patient to describe your situation, and the patient would say, "My arm is rising," but the person would deny that he had made the decision to raise his arm. In other words, the person knew, yes, my arm is raising, but I didn't make that decision. It's because you stimulated part of my brain with your electric probe, and therefore my arm automatically started to rise. So, he couldn't find the decision maker. Where is that entity that can either choose to make his arm rise or notice that he didn't choose to make the arm rise? It's happening because of some influence. Where is that entity located in the brain? He couldn't find it. Where is the thinker behind the thought, the commander behind the choice? Now, scientists can find the correct area in the brain where the decision is executed. Don't be fooled. They know. In this area of the brain, this decision happens. In that area of the brain, something else happens. But they can't find the decision maker. But so many people get fooled by this. Oh, the scientists know what area of the brain makes this decision, so on and so forth. But no, scientists cannot find the decision maker behind the decision, the thinker behind the thought, the commander behind the choice. One time, Penfield did an experiment where he stimulated the temporal lobes of human brains. And by doing that, he set off a flood of experiences from the past, complete with authentic sights, sounds, and smells. By his stimulating a certain part of the brain, all the past experiences would start flooding into the person's consciousness. A boy could hear his mother talking to him on the phone and could repeat the entire conversation. A woman saw herself in her kitchen and could hear her son playing outside. But in every case, when he asked the person who was being experimented upon, "Are you there in those scenes?" the person replied, "No, I'm on the operating table witnessing these experiences." So where is the witness in the brain? Where's the discriminator? He said, "I can't find." And he gave his final judgment a few days before his death. This Nobel laureate scientist said, "The brain is a computer, but it is programmed by something that is outside of itself." Another Nobel laureate, Sir John Eccles, wrote that, "I believe there is a fundamental mystery in my existence, transcending any biological account of the development of my body, including my brain." And before his death, he said, "If you look at most modern texts on evolution, you find nothing about mind and consciousness. They assume it just comes automatically with the development of the brain, but that's not the answer." In other words, if you want to really embarrass evolutionists, without getting into all the other aspects of evolutionary theory, ask them, how did consciousness evolve? They don't even deal with that. The most important thing about you, your consciousness, which allows you to be aware of everything. Where is the evolutionary theory that discusses the evolution of consciousness? Show us how consciousness evolves. No, can't do it. So this is how important consciousness is. And it is the most neglected area of current science. But it is the most voluminous area. It's the greatest area of research in the Vedic texts. Because the Vedic scholars understand, unless you understand consciousness, you can't understand anything you're aware of, because everything that you're aware of comes to you through your consciousness. Same thing Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita. Here's another statement by a famous atheistic scientist, Francis Crick. He wrote a famous book recently called The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. He's not looking for the soul, really. He just gives that title. He declares, "You, your joys and sorrows, your memories and ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells. You're nothing but a pack of neurons." Any of you think that that sounds comfortable? You're nothing but a pack of neurons. Do you think that scientific understanding of the physical processes of the neural system have given you understanding about the self and consciousness? Not at all. Now, another brain subject. For years, it has been thought, up until very recently, that although every cell in your body changes, your brain cells don't change. In fact, often when I would speak at universities and explain how Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that everything about the body changes, but the soul doesn't change, always someone would raise their hand and say, "Ah, but you don't know. The brain cells never change." How many of you thought that? Yes, most persons who know something about human anatomy, medical science, they assume for many, many decades the brain cells never change. The neurons you have at birth are what you have all your life. But in just a few years ago, that has been overturned. Now the research has shown that even the brain cells change. In other words, what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita is correct. Everything about the body changes. So, where is the self that doesn't change when everything about you in terms of chemistry and physiology changes? So where is the self at that doesn't change? Is it in the brain? But the brain cells change. So how is it you have a constant sense of identity? Core identity. Of course, you have your personality changes at the edges of it. But still, everyone recognizes you have a constant core identity. Where is that? Amidst all the changes of your body and your brain. Where? What I'm trying to do is to show you that it's completely illogical. It makes no sense at all to base your life on the bodily concept. I am this body. This is mythology. This is legend. This is fantasy. But most people don't think about that. Now, we're going to go to something. I might have told you this before, those of you who have heard our seminars before, but many persons become shocked out of their pants when they hear this. Can consciousness exist without its neural hardware? Meaning, can consciousness exist without a brain? What do you think? There are documented cases of people with no brain in their head, yet they're fully conscious. I was speaking about this at one university in Melbourne some years ago, and one professor got so outraged by this, he demanded, "Show me that proof, show me that documentation right now, I can't believe this." I said, "Well, I don't have it with me, come, it's at the flat where I'm staying." He followed me all the way back to the flat where I was staying, just so I would show him this, that there are people with no brain, yet are fully conscious, functioning entities. It was so upsetting to him. But it's true. And these studies are documented in prestigious scientific journals. One scientist he's a neurologist, John Lorber, of the University of Sheffield in England. He studied people who had not a brain, but water in place of a brain. You might have heard of water on the brain, but this is water in place of a brain. And he found that these persons were normal in their mental functions. Now, how does modern science explain this? How can you be a whole person, a functioning, normal person, without a brain? I thought the brain is the secret of consciousness. But here you see persons with no brain, they're fully aware. Now, some of these persons were disabled physically, but some of them had IQs greater than 100. The greatest challenge came from that very same university that John Lober was a research scientist at. I'll tell you, I'll read you the story. A brilliant student there at the University of Sheffield happened to visit his doctor. Noticing that the young man's head was larger than normal, the doctor referred him to the specialist John Lober, simply out of curiosity. The neurologist's routine brain scan revealed jolting evidence. Inside this student's head, a future mathematician with an IQ of 126, there was no brain. He graduated with first-class honors degree in mathematics. He's socially completely normal. He's got an IQ of 126, and in his head, there's no brain. Now, how do you explain that? How is it that consciousness emerges from the brain, and here are people with no brains, and first-class degree in honors, mathematics? No one has the answer to this. And these are the things no one likes to think about. Pursue the matter deeper, and you'll have to question yourself. How can any subjective conscious experience be explained as arising from any physical system, whether the brain or something else? This is the challenge. This is the Vedic challenge. All right. I hope I've given you enough information to provoke you to leave the shores of mythology and legend. Any questions? Yes.
When you ask the question, what is the difference between dead body and living body? So I was saying that it's feeling, willing, and desiring symptoms of soul. But you said, well, how about coma? So what is the situation in the coma? Why these symptoms are not experienced?
Well, you mentioned thinking, feeling, willing, but that's not anything that's measured physiologically. I wanted physiological symptoms, physical symptoms. But another question is what actually happens at coma. Coma means that your future is up in the air. Your next body hasn't been decided. And so, in a coma state, your next life is being negotiated. That's what happens.
But this coma is very particular to the modern period of life. We see too many cases, coma these days, and other in the past. So, how we can explain this?
People are more and more attached to their bodies. They don't want to move on to their next life. And their lives are very sinful. And they may get a glimpse of where they're heading in the next life and not want to go. And they can't stay. So they go into a coma state. They're put in a coma state. And so that, and finally they just give up and they leave it. They can't stay. They don't want to go.
Or probably in the ancient days, people did not know he was in coma. They buried him or they burnt him. Is that possible?
But people who come out of the coma, what about them? People who come out of the coma.
As I say, it's not clear yet what their future will be. They could go, they could stay. It's like a traffic jam, you know. Something has to give, one way or the other. They are going to die in some time in their life. But maybe it's not right at that moment. Maybe it will be at that moment. And in either case, whether they die now or later, they're very attached to not dying because they're afraid of the future.
After coming out of coma, do you still know, like,
what the future would be?
No. Do you remember your past death? Do you remember being born? Huh? Forgetfulness is a part of material life.
So, as you said, you give an example, like the body does not have a brain, but still does all the functions,
mm-hmm.
and having a very good intellectual function.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there a possibility that the soul can act without a body?
Yes.
So, how is the...
That's life in the spiritual world. That's reality.
But this is what we are seeing in material world, that a student not having brain. Is there a possibility on a material level?
Yes, the soul is independent of the body. It utilizes the body, but it's not completely dependent on it.
But why isn't it, if it is independent of brain, why isn't it independent of the whole body?
It is independent of the whole body.
But why can't we act without a body then?
Souls do act without a gross body. That's why ghosts bother people. Do you ever wonder what a ghost is?
No.
Ghosts are entities that don't have gross physical bodies. They only have subtle astral bodies because they were so sinful in their previous life that they don't merit a gross body. So they just have a subtle body of mind, intelligence, and false ego. And they bother people because they're envious. You have a gross body to fulfill your desires. I don't have a gross body. So they try to find weak-minded persons, especially those who take intoxication, and take over their body to experience their desires through that body.
So ghost is nothing but a soul.
With a subtle body. Yes, Krishna explains this in Bhagavad Gita, that you have a gross physical body and you have a subtle body. At the time of death, you drop your gross body, but the soul inside the subtle body goes to the next gross body. Do you understand? That's explained in Bhagavad Gita.
So when does the soul leave its subtle body?
At the time of freedom from material existence. In the third canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, it is explained by Lord Kapila, incarnation of Lord Krishna for teaching analytical knowledge, Sankhya Yoga. He explains that Bhakti Yoga dissolves the subtle body just like the digestive acids in the stomach dissolve food. So by your performing Bhakti Yoga, you're actually freeing yourself from your gross and subtle bodily influences. And the glory of the soul can manifest easily.
One more question. Is there any place inside the body where the soul is situated?
There's no physical sitting place, so to speak, because the soul is of a completely different energy. You can say, generally speaking, the soul is situated in the heart of the body, but that's not like saying you are in this room. There's no actual connection between matter and spirit. There's just the, how do we say, they come within the vicinity of each other, but they never actually connect right there.
But is it also not said that while the person is asleep, the soul, the consciousness moves towards the brain, towards the upper leg, something like that?
You may notice sometimes when you're sleeping that you seem to travel to other places. Yes, what happens is that the soul in the subtle body travels, but it comes back because it's not time for you to die. If it doesn't come back, it means you're dead. But it comes back. It's like when you're driving a car and you want to jump out at some petrol station to buy something. You leave the engine running, you jump out, buy something, go back in the car and drive away. Similarly, when you're sleeping at night and you're traveling, the soul temporarily leaves the engine running and gets out of the car and comes back. That's why many people have this experience. I don't know, any of you ever had an experience of going somewhere far off when you're sleeping? Anyone have it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's no big deal. Yes?
There's some stories about yogis in India.
Oh, there's so many stories about yogis in India. I'll be here all night. Start talking about yogis in India.
Saying that, I mean, they,
there are certain examples that they left the body and physically they found there are no activity at all, hot or anything, and they come back.
That's what Jesus Christ did. Jesus Christ was actually a mystic yogi. He was not dead at crucifixion. So, after a few days, he came back to life. But this is, for people in the West, this is an extraordinary thing. But in India, this is known as third class yoga. Really? Walking on water? You go to so many villages in India, you'll find some yogi who can walk on water or fly through the air. What's the big deal? But for Westerners, this is amazing. Ooh, miracle. So Jesus did those kind of things because he was talking, preaching to very ignorant people. People lived in the desert, fishermen like that. Whereas Krishna is speaking to Arjuna. Arjuna is far above the level of any human being today. The Pandavas far above the level of human beings today. So Krishna didn't resort to such things that any ordinary yogi can do. Walk on water, come back from the dead. Big deal.
Can you use your consciousness during the sleep?
Can you use your consciousness? What do you mean, can you use your consciousness? If you're absorbed in Krishna's service during the day, then at night you'll also think of Krishna and think of serving Krishna. So at least work on what you have direct control over when you're awake. And then gradually what happens when you're asleep will come into line. Will reflect what you're doing during the day. So first begin with the day. Again. If you chant Hare Krishna during the day, you absorb your mind in Bhagavad Gita during the day, then at night you'll think of Krishna, Krishna's service. So begin with the day. Okay?
Prabhu, just to change the topic, you give the example of Buddhimanta Prabhu who shifted to India and obviously to get some spiritual understanding. But as you again mentioned, in India again the situations are not...
I didn't say he shifted to India to get spiritual understanding. He's a married man, so probably he shifted because his wife wanted to go. That is something you'll understand later. Nothing theoretical.
Okay. So in India as well, the situation is not really... Say, we quoted the example of the things has changed so rapidly in Delhi. So, do you say India is more conducive to this such sort of thinking still, or we can...
Conducive to what sort of thinking?
To a spiritual advancement.
Not in the cities. Not in the cities. You live in Delhi, Bombay, it takes you 2 hours to get to work, 2 hours to get back, so many traffic jams, pollution in the air. Very difficult lifestyle. Unless you're very, very wealthy. Well, it's very difficult. The traffic is just horrible. The roads are jammed, the pollution. If you live in the village, okay. But none of you are going to live in the village. There you practice Krishna consciousness where you have the association of strong devotees. So I think you're making such an association here. So that's best. If you happen to have a very easy living situation in India, okay, but most of the time that's not so. You have to struggle so much. Driving is just horrible. You have no time. Here in Australia, yes, the atmosphere is more degraded, but the atmosphere of Indian cities is becoming very degraded very quickly. Here you do have more time. So, if you have the association of good devotees here, take advantage of it, become Krishna conscious. Yes, Budhi Mantha's family noticed that when they went back to Delhi. They thought, oh, this place is so bad. As one lady was saying, it's shocking what's going on there. You can get television from India on your satellite TV here?
Yeah.
You see it? What's going on? You see? Was not like that 10 years ago, was it? More and more musty, more and more provocative, more increasing all the time. Before, although, you know, as you know, every film from Bollywood has to have a dance in it. Before, it used to be traditional Indian dancing. You know, the girl would wave some cloth in the air, you know, signifying that she's enticing the man, you know. She'd have a sari on and she'd wave a cloth. Remember? You think it's like that now? No. She's wearing Western clothes or half-Western clothes and not doing maybe 10%, you know, traditional Indian dancing and 90% Western dancing. Yeah, you have seen, right?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And it's going more and more to the other side. In many of the movies, they're not even wearing anything Indian traditional at all, just a Western mini skirt, and you know, like dressing like Australian girls dress, you know, in Swanson Street or something, you know, and completely doing Western dancing. This is what the public wants. Yes, you have seen? Yeah.
You know, you said there was a student by Lober, like in
Lober
Way.
Yes.
Was that there was no tissues or anything like that, or there was something which...
Oh, you want to get into the fine print. There's always one of the other. He had 1.5% gray matter in his head. Now, if you're going to be a mundane scientist who's so intent on showing that consciousness comes from matter, you'll say, but that 1.5 gray matter in his head, that's where it all came from. That's where his 126 IQ came from. That's where all his powers came from. 98.5% of his brain matter is missing. Isn't that enough to say no brain? Would you say? Yeah. But I know there are a few hardcore materialists who will try to empower that 1.5% of gray matter and say, there's the reason. Forget it. If you accept evolution as Darwin presents it, why did these big brains evolve if just with 1.5% of your brain you could do everything? Why do you need a brain at all? Why did evolution provide a brain? It's not necessary. Ultimately, that is the fact. The brain is not necessary for consciousness to be there. Therefore, with these near-death experiences, as you were talking about, the near-death experiences, there's a flat EKG reading. You know what EKG is? It measures the brain activity. It's flat. It means the person's clinically dead. Yet, at that time, the person can remember all the things that happened. And when the person comes to, so to speak, the person can describe what was happening in the operating room while the EKG readings were flat. Clinically dead, no brain activity. That shows you consciousness is independent of the body. Okay, usually consciousness associates with a normally functioning brain, but it doesn't have to. That's the point. Consciousness functions under different laws than what govern matter and material bodies. So I'm telling you these things to try and shake you out of the world of legend and myth. It's hard work, but I hope that I'm making some progress. Yes.
Then what is subconscious mind? Does it have, is it something different? Like, because what I've read somewhere was, when we are like this, during the day when we are like, you know, normal functioning, it's our conscious mind that works. And otherwise, when we are sleeping, we are like 95% of this subconscious mind. And if we use more of our subconscious mind, we'll be more like, we can memorize more and all that stuff.
Mind is mind, whether it's conscious or subconscious. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, you have the gross physical body, and then you have a subtle body. The subtle body is composed of mind, intelligence, and false ego. So whether the mind is visible to you or not, it's there. Yes, there are so many untapped powers of the mind. Some people can even, with their mental intensity, bend a spoon. We've got so many IT persons here. Have any of you noticed that if you really concentrate hard with your mind, you affect the computer? Right. Any of you notice that?
Yeah.
It happens to me all the time. If I'm meditating on something on the computer screen very intensely, the screen changes. Because that is the power of the mind. Some people can bend a spoon with their mind. It's been scientifically tested. They can do that. So, yes, there is vast, untapped mental power, just like people have untapped muscle power. If you develop your physical muscles, you can do more. If you develop your mental powers, you can do more. But more powerful than the body, more powerful than the mind, or intelligence, or false ego, is the spirit soul. Bhakti yoga, Sanatan Dharma, Krishna consciousness means developing the power of the soul. That's far more powerful, immeasurably more powerful.
Mm-hmm. One more question. You say that after near death experience, when the person becomes alive, he remembers what was going on.
Yes.
But the person in the coma, how does he doesn't know what is going on?
How does he?
Doesn't know what is going on or what is supposed to go on in the future.
You're not the controller of your awareness. This is another thing Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. There's the soul and the super soul. It is the super soul who modulates or regulates how much you can remember, how much you can forget. The great mistake of current scientific knowledge is to think that your knowledge and remembering ability is under your control. No. You can't remember your previous death. You can't remember your birth. You can't even remember exactly what you did 2 days ago at this time. Because of the super soul, your knowledge is regulated. How much you can remember. So it's not just up to you. Some people can remember in the coma what's going on around them. They just can't express it while they're in the coma, but some people remember. Everything is different in terms of remembrance, and that difference is provided by the super soul in the heart. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that there are two entities in the body, not just the individual soul, but also the super soul, the supreme soul. And the individual soul is dependent on the super soul for its knowledge and remembrance.
Maharaj, India was originator of Vedic knowledge. But what has set in? What went wrong that degradation has taken place in India only?
India is the land of Krishna and they've forgotten Krishna.
No, but why has it happened? Like, the good souls were there all along. What went wrong?
Bad leaders.
Can you also say Kali Yuga? The effect of Kali Yuga?
That's part of Kali Yuga, bad leaders.
But when the Mahabharata was fought, that was another Yuga.
Yes.
At that time, the treatment which Draupadi got from the Kaurava, was it better than present age?
The treatment of what? Yes, that's better than the previous age. Better than this age, yes. That what you're asking?
Yeah, what was the, how it is better? Like the way she was humiliated in the public, probably now.
That's a daily event these days. And the ladies don't consider it humiliation, they consider it an honor. Yes, you've seen movies both from Hollywood and Bollywood, yes? Yes? It's considered an honor to be disrobed in public. These are the stars, the celebrities, right? But during Draupadi's time, it was considered the greatest insult. Therefore, Bhima vowed at that point, I'm going to smash these guys. What did he specifically say? What did Bhima vow to do?
Yes.
So, that, it was taken to be such a horrible thing. Of course, she could not be disrobed because Krishna incarnated as her sari. But nowadays, complete disrobing is an everyday affair. People will applaud. Oh, wonderful. They'll pay money to see it. Hollywood star. And Bollywood is becoming like that very soon. Very soon. So yes, this is a much worse time. There's no moral understanding whatsoever. Because the whole purpose of morality has been forgotten. Because India has forgotten Krishna, therefore all these inauspicious things are happening. But at the same time, there is a great effort in some sections of India to remember Krishna. And exciting things are happening on the spiritual front. So basically, when I go to India now, I see these two opposing forces. Yeah. You have the revival of Krishna consciousness, and you have the surge of decadence and degradation. Both these are going on together. It'll be an interesting future of the country.
Yeah. The news, at least in the night, they are the manifestation of what? Because some people.
They are what?
They are manifestation. They are manifestation of what?
Why?
Because some people say we don't have control over our dreams. So the dreams.
Yes, you can learn to control your dreams. It's not worth the effort, but you can learn to do that. You've got better things to do with your life than play around in the dream world. Here, right here in Melbourne, you can take New Age courses in how to control your dreams. It was a big deal.
Well, even after imparting the whole 18 chapters in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna fights and wins the war, everything is fine. But even after that, his ego is not completely dead, I suppose, because he stays in front of Bhagavana, his son. He doesn't know that he is his son. And he says that, no, I won the Pashupatastra, I did this, I did that, and he gets killed by Bhagavana. There is a story which can be found even in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So how do you relate this? Why is it that Arjuna's ego or his self had not completely got revived even after listening to Bhagavad Gita right from the Supreme Person's mouth?
Arjuna is Krishna's eternal associate. He was put into that situation of forgetfulness by Lord Krishna himself so that you would have a perfect example of what it's like to be an illusion. Krishna is teaching you by using Arjuna, his dear devotee. So he went through all that as a lesson to you. This is Krishna's mercy upon you, that he's teaching you through his own dear devotee, his eternal associate Arjuna. He's teaching you what's it like to be in Maya. But there's no question of Arjuna losing his spiritual status. Krishna has him acting that way for your benefit.
So is it possible that even after most of us, even after understanding the Bhagavad Gita, or say even the Bhagavatam, we may also feel that ego come into us and we may also act in that way? Is it not possible? And we can also say that that is because Lord is making us do it?
No, that's the difference between you and Arjuna. It's not all the same.
Down the line, may say something. Somebody else, maybe after 1,000 years, they may say that, okay, these people were there and they were made to be done like this because it was the Lord's wish.
That's why we have the Shastra. That's why we have Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, to explain clearly what is what. Otherwise, you could just speculate this, speculate that. That's why we need to follow the guidelines given in the Vedic literature. And that way you'll understand what is what. Otherwise, you can go on and on. Maybe this, maybe that. Maybe God made me do this. Maybe I'm God. On and on it goes. Very simple. Sat means eternal. Chit means knowledge. Ananda means bliss. That is the nature of your life in spiritual existence. Eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. That's your natural lifestyle. And what does material life mean? Us, sat, at, chit, and nirananda. Asa, temporary, achit, ignorance, and nirananda, without bliss. So you take your pick, satchitananda or asa, achit, nirananda. Choose your lifestyle.
My understanding is chit means consciousness.
All Sanskrit words have several meanings, so you have to understand them in context. Full consciousness means full knowledge.
Just now we were discussing about that brain is not necessary to execute bodily functions and to it's a seat for the consciousness. So how can we describe or explain different degree of intelligence in different persons?
Intelligence is based on your karma from your past life. It is a material thing. Spiritual intelligence is not based on your karma. Different persons are born in this world with different karmic loads. So it may be that your karma gives you bad intelligence or bad health or poverty, or it may be that your karma gives you good material intelligence, good wealth, good health. But spiritual intelligence is not dependent on your karma. Spiritual intelligence depends on your service in relationship to Krishna.
So how does it's like if you are not devotee, we won't be Krishna conscious. So it has to start somewhere. Means how we, because we need to be first devotee, then only we will be Krishna conscious. Or we have to be Krishna conscious, then we will be devotee.
How do you begin your Krishna consciousness? By associating with Krishna conscious persons, as you're all doing now. And by taking food that's been offered to Krishna. And by chanting Krishna's name. By trying to understand who is Krishna. Trying to understand the science of Krishna. You're all starting to do that. So you've all started your Krishna consciousness. How far you go is up to you.
What I mean is, for a beginner, there is no faith. You know, there is no faith whether this is going to work. Means, is this the right
You're not thing? Sure, but you have a little bit of faith enough to come here for this weekend. You might trick yourself. Oh, I'm just going there because it's a peaceful place out there. I'm going there because I have nothing else to do this weekend. You can trick yourself like that. That's okay.
Even if that works, means even if you don't mean to get something, but if you go into that process.
You may not mean to put your hand in the fire, but if you touch fire, it'll burn you. So just by being in this gathering, you'll become affected. Now, how much you want to respond to that being affected, that's up to you. But just by coming here, you have begun your Krishna consciousness. We're talking about Krishna. We're discussing Bhagavad Gita. We're explaining the effects of Krishna consciousness and the effects of the lack of Krishna consciousness. That's how subtle faith or shraddha is. A little bit of appreciation is the beginning of faith. So many of you are agreeing, yes, this makes sense, yes. The other way does not make sense. That's the beginning of faith. So many of you are agreeing, I thought that the Vedas were legend and myth. Now I see that material life is a legend, it's a myth. Okay.
When we talk about Mahabharata, there are lots of issues which is really confusing. For example, Draupadi and her five husbands. And how can we defend that?
How can you defend it?
No. How can we define?
Define. That is not in this age. Draupadi is an extraordinary person. And she was present during another age. The Vedic rule is that a man can have more than one wife, but a woman can only have one husband. The exceptions are very extraordinarily rare, like Draupadi. What was Draupadi's rareness? She could treat each of her five husbands exactly the same. Now, if you know anything about female psychology, you know generally that's completely impossible. A woman always likes one man better than the other. But Draupadi was such an extraordinarily unique person, she treated all five Pandavas completely equally. That's it. That's, if you know female psychology, which you probably will at some point in your life. You'll know, it's impossible.
But still, it's not convincing. Like,
what do you mean? Like, convincing for who?
I mean, an Indian woman having five husbands.
You're not allowed to do that. And these days, we are very happy if a man can take care of one wife, but just think of five wives. This is Kali Yuga, the age of degradation and quarrel. Things are different. Mahabharata's from a previous age. The Pandavas could easily visit other planets, back and forth. You can't do that. What about the arrows that Arjuna was firing? The arrows that the warriors in Kurukshetra were firing. Do you see those kind of arrows around these days?
Yeah.
Answer the question. Huh? So why you pick on one thing and, you know, make a big thing out of it? No. Draupadi, yeah. Everything is different.
That's great. No, okay. What I'm wondering is, they are such a powerful characters.
Yeah?
And that's such a beautiful concept. Krishna has said, oh, everything is beautiful. And this is only one thing which really shatters everything.
You're worried? You're going to marry a woman who has five husbands? What is your anxiety about? What is your anxiety about?
Because if somebody is asking these kind of questions regarding our religion or which is related to our Bhagavad Gita, and if he points out, what does this mean? And it entirely
just tell them this is not for this present age, and even in the previous age, in Dwarpa Yuga, Draupadi was not an ordinary person, even when you take into account the previous age, which was much more advanced than that. Generally, when people ask that kind of question, they have a motive for asking that. They're not innocent. They want to prove that, you know, there's something wrong. You cannot understand these Vedic literatures from the outside. You have to enter within. Just like, your hope, maybe, what, you'll get a job here in Australia and send money back to your family? Is that your hope?
Probably is.
Yeah, but to the average Australian, they think, why do you have to do that? Your family is one thing, you're another. Just make money and spend it all on yourself.
If that's the question, I can say, shut up, that's none of your business.
Okay, then. Thank you. You answered my question. How many Australians have you met who work and give money to their family? Right. Yeah, they got their life, I got mine. If they need money, the government will take care of them. That's why I pay taxes, you know?
Don't care. In fact, they say don't care about parents.
Parents didn't care for us. Why are we, you know? Most of the time, I don't even know who my father is. Father doesn't want to know about me. Mother and father separated a long time ago. Life still goes on. It's a big deal. They got their life, I got mine. They're trying to be happy, I'm trying to be happy. But you say, you won't explain why you send money to your parents. None of your business. Meaning, don't stick your nose in affairs you don't understand, right? So if that's the way you are about your little tiny life, then why can't you tell the people to stick to keep their noses out of all bars also?
Because I think I'm nothing. So it doesn't matter if he asks some questions about me. Mm-hmm. But I think it's about India.
It's not simply that you think you're nothing. It's also you think you don't understand, you're not able to understand.
Yeah, that's correct.
Similarly, without some kind of good fortune, good assets, good qualities, they cannot understand Mahabharata's Bhagavad Gita. That good fortune has to be created through the association of devotees. Just like so many of you, we're thinking that Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's teachings are legend, myth, but in good association you're starting to think another way. Okay? Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, about the spiritual intelligence, does it also
increase? Oh, yes. Yes. You like to experience that? You begin the bhakti path and you'll see that you'll understand Krishna more and more. You'll understand Bhagavad Gita more and more. The full knowledge is there within you, but it's covered by the material energy. So as you gradually wake up in Krishna consciousness, you'll see that you know more and more. It's like the sun gradually rising more and more in the morning. I wish that you will have that experience.
Again, at the higher level, there happens to be, at the higher level, if you go on asking these Brahmins and all, they come up to a level where they speak Dvaita and Advaita.
Mm.
Dvaita means you are...
I am understanding.
Dvaita and Dvaita.
Yes,
so
yes.
What basically... See, Madhvas, they follow this Dvaita or Advaita, I don't know.
Running into trouble already, huh? There I go on.
What basically is that Dvaita and Advaita? They say that we are all servants of God, and others say, I am God, you don't have to worry, something like that. So, are you God or who is God? What is this?
Welcome to modern India. And you ask me, why is India the way it is now? Am I the servant of God? Am I God?
Except for, and in the in this one itself, the whole of Krishna, Brahmana, Vaishna, Shudra, up to that level, he has brought something. Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra. So they say that they are supreme and this class has to do this type of work, this class has to do this type of work. All this bifurcation. And coming up above, lastly they will say, this is what? I am Dvaita, you are Advaita. Come on, let's fight with this one. there is no such thing that Vaishnavites, in Vaishnavas itself, Krishna is the avatar of Vishnu, Rama is the avatar of Vishnu. So is that from Matsya to Kali it has come. So all the forms are Krishna's avatar. So why is that differentiation between Rama and Krishna again there?
Ask me one question. Which question?
Dvaita and Advaita.
Okay. Dvaita means different. Advaita means non-different. So, you are both Dvaita and Advaita. You are qualitatively equal to Krishna, but you're quantitatively different from Krishna. You understand? Just like the particle of gold is equal to the gold mine, but there's a tremendous difference in quantity. So you have the same quality. You're, as spirit soul, you have the same quality as the Supreme Soul, Krishna. But in quantity, there's a huge difference. Krishna is infinite, and you are finite. So if you want to say that you're God, you have to say you're a little God. Okay?
Maharaj,
you're the drop of water, but you're not the ocean.
Maharaj,
that is what Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Mamaivamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. You living entities are all certainly my eternal parts, my amshas. Mama eva amsha. You're certainly my parts. You're not the complete whole. Okay? Is Bhagavad Gita, what's the problem? So you don't get confused. You study Bhagavad Gita, you understand. Otherwise you hear so many things.
Yeah, but Bhagavad Gita can be told in terms of Dvaita or Advaita or Vishishta Advaita or any of these three things.
Why make life complicated? What does Krishna say? Mamayamamsho jiva loke. You are certainly my amsha, my part. Is there some difficulty understanding that? You're not the whole, you are the part of the whole.
This is also a play of Krishna?
No!
Because
no! Where does Krishna say, I'm just playing around?
It's a play for Krishna. Huh? The whole of this universe, he wants to see, what is my work is?
It's a play for Krishna, but not for you.
No, not
for you. For you, it's suffering.
Yeah, that is what.
But,
what
so, okay, then how are you going to get out of this suffering?
No, I'm not telling you.
And what is your plan for getting out of suffering?
Let me explain.
You explain how you're going to get out of suffering. Are you an engineer?
No, I'm not an engineer. I'm a CNC programmer.
Okay, how are you going to devise a program to get you out of material existence?
You are not actually answering my this one. What I am asking is, it's a play for Krishna. He will allow you to act freely in this world. I have given you one life, you act freely. Whether you want
just like in the prison, you can act freely while you're in prison. You call that freedom? Huh? You want to act freely in prison?
In the sense, whatever.
Answer my now. I answered your question. Now you answer my question. You want to act freely in prison?
No.
Why not? Do you know in America they have capital punishment? You know, if you murder someone voluntarily, then you can be given the death penalty in many states. So do you know that on your last morning before you're executed, you can ask for whatever meal you want. How do you like that freedom? Your last meal, you can order whatever you like. They'll bring it to you before they kill you. You call that freedom?
No.
So why should we be attracted to freedom in a prison house? Get out of the prison house. That's real freedom. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that you're born into this world because you have iccha dvesha samudrayena dvanda mohena bhavata. You're born into this world overcome by attachment and aversion. you want to imitate Krishna, you want to be God, and you hate following the instructions of God. This is the psychology of taking birth in the material world. So there's no freedom. There's just a delusion that you have so many options. But you're so curtailed, you're so restricted by birth, death, disease, and old age. You just imagine in your mind you're free. Just like, you know, when you're watching television, you have the remote control in your hand, yes? Which for my watch, which channel? So many choices, right? You feel that sense of power, yes? With the remote control in your hand? You've done it, yes? Look at this for a while. Now I'll switch to another channel. Look at that. This way you can pass your whole night. Is that freedom? Mm-hmm. Alright. So look at your whole material life in that way. You'll see there's no freedom. Now when Krishna comes to this world, he's completely free. It's a play for him. You're right. Because Krishna is the controller of material nature. He's not under the influence of material nature. Material nature is his energy. How does he become influenced by his energy? Not possible. He explains that in Bhagavad Gita. Ajopi san avyatma, bhutanam ishvaro pisan. Prakatam samadhisthaya, sambhavami atmamaya. Krishna says, although I'm unborn, although I have a body that's inexhaustible, and although I'm the Lord of all living entities, I still come into this world. But I come my way. Sambhavami atmamaya. I come through my own spiritual mechanism into the material world. I'm unaffected by the material energy. So what is play for Krishna is suffering for you. But if you take shelter of Krishna, as he says at the end of Bhagavad Gita, if you surrender to Krishna, then it's possible to cross over the illusions of material life. Alright? Okay. I think that's enough for now. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you.